This is Eric Schachtwist. See you at the show. We are on site at the Station Theater in Urbana. I'm with my co-host for tonight, sitting in for LaDonna Wilson, Latrell Bright. Hi,
hey,
Latrell.
Hi.
So great to run into you tonight.
Yes.
After Elephant Graveyard, and you just can't get enough theater, can you?
No. Anxious to talk about the show.
So I am joined by three of the stars of Farinelli and the King and the director, Tanya Arazi-Combs. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, it's great to be on your show.
It is great to have you. And thanks to you and thanks to our actors who are here, Kara Marizzi, Aaron Miller, and James Hevel. I know it's late. It's a wonderfully long show. And so I appreciate you staying here into the night to talk to us about it, because I am very excited to have some of my questions answered, to hear some of your thoughts on this production. Well, first of all, congratulations, Tanya. This is a really magnificent piece of art you've created in a space that is really well suited for it. It's as big of a stage as I've ever felt in here.
And I wanted to have the feel of the Baroque. That's why a lot of things are painted on the set. That took a lot of time and effort, but I think it was worth it. I think it looks really beautiful.
I guess I should just say also the costumes were fantastic.
Who did the costumes for this? They were absolutely. Brianna Malotki was our costume designer, and she was fabulous. She loves working in this period. And so when she came on to the production, she was all ready to go with lots of ideas. She was absolutely wonderful.
And I would say that 18th century theater sensibilities really work in this space. It's a really wide and shallow space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love what Yvonne Tesman did as mm-hmm. far as forced perspective and then the painted backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
That was all really very lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wrote down just in the very first 5 minutes, I wrote costumes, lighting, set, wigs, because it was like those were things that I thought all deserved to be pointed out. Did you have access to like U of I costumes?
Some things were from U of I, some things were from Homer. Some things were built for the production, like the forest costumes of the King.
Oh, that's why they could
match.
Yes. And I believe the funeral look, or not the funeral look, but the in mourning look
mm-hmm.
Was built as well.
Several pieces put together to make something period looking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I really loved that they matched, because that was a point in the relationship where y'all were kind of on the same
mm-hmm.
on the same plane there. Yeah.
Ever so briefly,
yes.
Tragic.
It is. So James, I have not seen you perform before, though most of your experience is opera. Have you done musicals before or?
This is the most dialogue since high school. I can't tell you what the show was or what I was doing, but I took one look at this script and was like, I was highlighting it on my first day and I was like, oh. Oh no. This is not my comfort zone. I'm a singer. It really, I think, was a fantastic learning experience for me. Because I always think that opera singers in particular need to be pushed out of their comfort zone and out of the crook of the piano and be forced to just feel something. You know? I mean, the music is always so passionate on its own. And I think that sometimes we get so caught up in making a beautiful sound that we can't feel it. So this was a really great experience for me.
Well, it's definitely unique. Were you familiar with the show before Tanya approached you, or however? I guess, how did the magic happen? How did she find you?
I was not aware of the show, but we had met briefly, and then out of nowhere, I ran into Tanya at the mall, and I think I've honestly been to the mall here like 2 times. So the odds of this happening were very slim. And I was in Forever 21,
mm-hmm.
and she goes, James? And I was like, you? I know your face. And we just started talking, and she was like, you know, I know this is kind of random, but there's this interesting show that I think would be perfect for your voice. It's called Farinelli and the King. Last I knew, the rights weren't available, but because it's so new, I mean, it was just on Broadway.
So I tracked it down. I've been tracking this down for 2 years. So I saw this in 2017 in New York. And I left, I was like, oh, this would be a really cool thing because it bridges both my interests. I'm a director and I'm a singer, and I'm like, great, I could, you know, this is something that really speaks to me. So I followed up with them, like after they closed, and when it was time to submit for the station, I emailed them again and they said, actually, I think it's gonna come out in a couple weeks. We'll let you know. I'm like, oh, perfect. So I waited, they emailed me, I think I was, this should be the very first regional production of this show.
Wow.
But I tracked them down for a year and a half.
So did
you, diligent time.
Yes.
Did you get to see it with when Mark Rylance was the king?
Yes. Well, I think he was the only other, Aaron's the second king that has ever played this part.
Hey, well, congratulations, Aaron. Aaron, so you are you a Champaign native?
No, I'm originally from Ohio, the Cleveland area.
So, okay. And what other shows have you done here locally?
It was about 2 years ago here. We did Miss Bennett Christmas at Pemberley.
Okay.
Mr. Darcy and that.
Oh, Joy Hofsummer's show.
Yeah. Well, I was in Pride and Prejudice with Joy.
Oh, okay.
I was Mr. Collins. And when I saw that script and it didn't have Mr. Collins, I was crushed. So there are just a lot of things that came up while watching you, because I thought the evolution of your... I don't know if it's your healing or the evolution of your sickness was really, really well done. So how did you think of your evolution through those stages?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that the music was very much sort of reaching him on a level that he had never really expected from music before. Through the whole thing, I think that process is really coming back to himself, going back to the 10-year-old, you know, eventually, like in Act Two, how he comes back to the 10-year-old who, you know, strips off his clothes and jumps into the fountain, but then he was beaten. So, you know, it's kind of like a redeeming of that through hearing how Farinelli, you know, he's very much interested in that interrogation about, you know, like how this happened, how old were you, you know, who did it, and why did they do this? And I think it's kind of through that interrogation, he kind of feels his bond with Farinelli, and that increases the healing process. I guess he's kind of going back to his childhood and reliving some of that, but in a healing way through the music.
Yeah, well, it seemed as though during that interrogation, you were trying to create some parallels between what made him great or have any of his followers, I think you talked about. There was almost like his castration was his coronation.
Right.
Did I write that down? Did you say that?
Well, not quite, but yeah, I think that was almost implied.
Okay. Yeah, and then throughout, I couldn't tell if you were in love with him, if you were envious of him, if you were grateful for him. I mean, what was the emotion that you were trying for?
Well, I think it was a relationship that was very much through music.
My seat was extreme stage left, and so I had a really good angle of you on your bed when he first started singing, and I was really interested in that. I think I was watching you too, Kara, of how, you know, not just did you sit up, but then it seemed as though you were kind of, your things were starting to work inside your brain, and I think that you did that through your eyes, and I think you were kind of sharing something together with her too. So, Kara, you know, do you feel like you also changed as he was changing, or were you more steady?
Yeah, I really think the Queen goes through a very big emotional journey and roller coaster through the play. You know, she starts out very rock solid on duty, and this is my lot in life, and this is what I must do, and I must support my husband, and I have these things I must carry out. And then love kind of changes and morphs. And because of her love of her husband, she brings this new element into the palace, and suddenly, you know, she even says, I don't know who I am anymore by Act Two.
Right.
So I feel like she has a very big arc as far as, you know, who she is at the end of the play versus who she was at the beginning.
Well, that was interesting, because right before you said that line, I think you said, when he was ill, I knew who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you said, and now I don't even know who I am.
Yes.
And I think that maybe that's kind of like an interesting sort of a caregiver sort of...
A little codependency going on there. You know, she needed to feel needed, and then she provided this cure, this, you know, salve for him, and then it was like, what do I do now? You know, and it was very conflicted for her, because she does love her husband, but that love is peppered with violence and some abuse and some passion and all kinds of things. And then we have this other love that's sort of pure and innocent and not attainable. And so it's all the more attractive, I think.
Why do you think that she thought music would work? Because I don't think there was a clue that we were given overtly about that.
I've had my own theories about it. I think there's a lot of talk about her being Italian, that it's in her blood, that music is just innate in her. And she even talks about it, that, you know, her mother loved music. In some of our research, we found out that she studied instruments. She loved music, dancing, all of those things, and yet she wasn't able to create it herself. She couldn't sing. So she was very enamored and almost envious of those who could. So I think she really connected with the music and the story, and felt that that was something that was healing for her. The experience was overwhelming when she first heard his voice, so why not? Let's try some music therapy and see.
Yeah. Well, I think it was a shock, probably for most people seeing this have not seen a male soprano. I haven't, at least not that I've been, not in an opera context. And it was interesting because I'm such a big Hadestown fan. And then when you said you would make a great Orpheus, and I was trying to think of, like, you would make a great Orpheus, as they say in the show. And also it's interesting because that whole arc of, in Hadestown, of what Orpheus does, it's through the power of his song could even change the heart of Hades. And so here it wasn't so much changing a bad heart, but it was waking up a heart that didn't have life, I guess. I saw there's going to be a movie version. That was in the director notes.
Oh, wow.
Is that something that's, like, seriously already happening, or is that a pipe dream? Do you
apparently,
know, Tanya?
Apparently, it's in the works. I'm excited to see what a film might look like. Claire Van Kampen is very talented and is involved in many different things, and film is one area that she is working in.
Okay. I think that might have been what made me think of King's Speech, was just trying to envision what sort of a movie this would be like, and just seeing, like, somebody, instead of finding, like, his voice, finding, I don't know, what did you find? Was it sanity, or was it yourself?
Well, I think, it was finding himself, but then it got cut off again because, you know, he had the responsibilities of going back to Madrid and the whole thing about he's not sure why Farinelli is leaving. Like, when he first decides to leave, it's a big question to him. And then it almost seems like Farinelli, I mean, that's the way I was understanding it, that Farinelli was then becoming part of the so-called conspiracy. You know, so he's falling back into his madness sort of as things were crumbling apart, when for him, he was just starting to find himself again. So, and I guess, yeah, in my mind, I guess finding himself and returning to sanity are kind of the same thing.
Right.
You know, and I think in that speech in Act Two, it's very much, he's finding out what it is to be a king. He's addressing the people, and it's the people he could never see from court because it would always be filtered through his ministers and everything else, and it would never be these people that are right here before us. They're not afraid of the earth. They're not afraid of their desires. You know, and he's actually speaking to them, and this is what a king should be doing. But then it's, you know, a scene after that, he's got to go back to Madrid, and he's just finally discovering it, and it's the first glimmer of it, and it's getting cut off. So then it descends back to where it was before.
Right. Well, some of the parallels that your characters, I think, have to do with, like, the imposter syndrome, where you're in a role, and then you're not quite sure if you're worthy of the role, and I think that with the decision to not have Farinelli and the singer be separate people, mm-hmm. that maybe we didn't see that quite as much.
I actually don't know that that's true, because if you think about if you think about the King, for instance, the King takes the exact same trajectory. And they just have one person. It is about the role, and it's about who he really wants to be. It's the same thing with Farinelli. I don't know. I didn't ask the author about this, but I would suppose, because I'm an opera singer as well, that a greater reason for doing that is it's just a very, very practical reason. It's very hard if you're going to do a Broadway show to have an opera singer sing every night and then talk every night.
Eight shows a week.
That's not possible. So within the context of a Broadway show, it would make sense to have two characters. They're taking the exact same trajectory, so I don't think it's muddled at all. Because then you would have to say, it's not like she had two characters playing the King. He's going through the exact same trajectory. So I think these two mirror each other. It's just in this production over here, and I also, because I'm an opera singer, I feel opera singers are able to get up and act. And I think there's not enough credit given to opera community. And so that, you know, I think my decision was based on, you know, a variety of reasons.
That was a passionate argument. I do want to say that I didn't say muddled.
Yeah.
So, but I do think that the lines when Farinelli said the notes didn't belong to me, they belonged to him. And then I was kind of, I guess that's when, because I knew that there was an option mm-hmm. to have the separation, that I was kind of trying to see if he really, just in the arc that we were seeing, mm-hmm. if he views himself as having sort of two different selves.
And you notice the King has a similar line, you know, at the beginning where, you know, he didn't even want to be called King. It's the exact same thing.
Right.
So they are taking, if you actually listen to the lines, it's the exact same thing. I really believe, and I don't know this for fact, but I do believe it has everything to do with a practical reason. And then you build the story around that. If I was creating the story, that's what I would do. I don't know.
What were you going to say?
James.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there, in some parts of the show, I think that there's a benefit to having two physical characters, because you get such a strong visual of two separate identities, mm-hmm. Farinelli and Carlo, and they can interact with each other, you know? And I think that, especially in the beginning of the show, I think that that could be, of course I did not see the production, could be very powerful. But I also think that in some moments of the show, it would not make sense. Like Cara Sposa, that song is really the only song in the show that he sings for himself.
Where did that take place?
That was right after
the kiss.
The kiss.
Ha!
So
I'm just gonna say, like I told Latrell during intermission, I'm not a big opera fan.
Uh
huh. And especially not a big like I Sopranos do not sit well with my ear and my sensibilities. But I wrote down here my favorite aria was after the Isabella. Love kiss. I don't know what love kiss means, but that's what I wrote. But that was my favorite too.
It's a really strong, emotional, heartfelt piece that Farinelli is singing for himself. It's the only song in the show that he sings literally for himself. Everything else is for the King, you know, for someone else. And to me, if you were to have that last line, you know, singing for you, thank you. And then you have that person leave and another human being walk on stage or sing it from, you know, the heavens. It just, to me, that moment wouldn't have the same impact.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, it's a different production with different limitations and different stuff going on. I know that I personally have loved the challenge of getting to act on stage and also sing. So personally, I'm really thankful for the opportunity. But yeah, I can see kind of both sides of it.
Yeah, well, there were the other line that I thought when you said, I'm not famous, Farinelli's famous. Mm-hmm. And I thought that then that would, you know, I was kind of just picturing like, you know, like your allusion to that other guy. And he, and it still was there. It didn't need the physical. That's why I agree with you, Tanya. It didn't need it all the time, but I guess, and maybe I was a little bit distracted because I was kind of thinking like what would it be like the other way instead of being fully immersed in what I was getting. But obviously I liked it a lot. So, and I think one of the really interesting things, who talked about everything in this world like having its shadow, but then we're no longer wholly ourselves once our shadow comes?
Yeah, that was at the end of the first scene after he throws the fish. Yeah, to put the fire out.
What is the actual, I bungled it, but I felt really profound. Yeah, what is the message
everything
there?
Everything produced in this world has its shadow, even at the beginning. When we are taken from the safety of the dark, then are we no longer wholly ourselves. We have been claimed by others. It is how nations become great. So that's the line. Yeah, do you want to get into interpretation of it? I guess, I guess you think, you know, something produced, everything produced in this world is kind of the act of creation or something. It has its shadow, being sort of going back to the nothingness before there is creation. And, you know, emerging from that, you're automatically claimed. Once you're emerging into a creative, you know, from creation, you're already in a whole, and therefore you're claimed by others. You're not just an isolated individual. And, you know, you're claimed by others, and you have to, you know, you're taken from the safety of the dark. So, I think even in his madness, he's somewhat lucid that he's saying those sorts of things.
Yeah, right. It was profound, and I'm glad that I got you to actually do the line.
Okay.
Because now I can go and play that back and get it again without having to come back and see the whole show just for that. In the very first show that I did at Parkland, it was a Little Prince, and I thought a few times about the Little Prince with the notion of listening to the stars, because that's something that the aviator, and I kind of felt like you were a little bit of the aviator and you were a little bit of the Little Prince, which is getting to kind of feel, to unlock this person that's inside yourself. And you actually seemed kind of like there was youth inside you. You were kind of unbridled once you had the influence of Farinelli and his music.
Yeah, I think very much it was, you know, sort of awakening his childhood again. I think the character himself is somewhat, I wouldn't say childish, but it's the sort of inner child, you know, in him that he's trying to, you know, discover again, and the music helps him with that. So.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this is, we should wrap up, but this has been See You at the Show, Station Theater, for how many more shows do we have, Tanya?
This week, eight more week. Shows. Yeah, eight
more opportunities.
Eight more opportunities.
That's exciting, yeah.
We've got one matinee on Sunday. Nine more shows. My stage manager is telling me nine more shows. This is why I have a lovely stage manager, Gabby Bruno.
May I just ask one question?
Do it, Latrell.
About, there's something about, I keep getting stuck on the Station Theater choosing this show with its 18th century kind of sensibilities of sitting and listening to music and kind of the patience that it takes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you handled that, because I think most of what we do around here is, you know, fast-paced, the contemporary thing that was just on Off-Broadway, the hot new thing, and very contemporary. We don't usually do period pieces. Even when we do Shakespeare, we update it. So there's something about sitting in that I think the show did, and I just don't know how that played into the rehearsal process.
Well,
I mean, it feels like,
yeah.
I mean, it's a play about opera, so in some ways the play feels like an opera.
Yeah.
And that's not our audience.
Sure. Well, and it's very, the story itself is very operatic in just how grand and how dramatic and almost kind of
heightened.
It's very heightened, and it also, it moves very fast. It's a little herky-jerky emotionally, because you're like, oh my gosh, they're there in the forest. Then Farinelli's leaving. Then, oh, he's staying. Then, oh, the king is, oh, dead. And Farinelli's back in a gray wig, you know? So there's certainly a lot going on, which is opera.
But I mean, there's something about you have to love the music.
Yes. And
without distraction, even.
Yeah, and it does take a concentration that I think that in 2019, a lot of people don't want to have the patience for.
Or just don't. We're not.
Or
it feels like an acquired taste.
It's a privilege to be able to sing it. And whoa, trying to live up to Farinelli's, you know, the bar that Farinelli's at has been, it's really nice.
Well, there is a good amount of music in the show, but I also, if there's anybody listening who has, you know, an aversion thinking that they're coming to an opera, the music, I would say you have maybe 6 or 7 different pieces about 3 minutes long. And so they're kind of spread out. So it really is a nice doses of beautiful music.
Yeah, they're short little excerpts there, and they're all really catchy and beautiful. And she chose very wisely all these pieces. There are so many Handel arias out there, I cannot even tell you. But she really picked ones that the emotion and the text in that very moment is either exactly what the king needed or exactly what I needed. And it makes the story make even more sense, almost.
Yeah, can it just wash over you?
Yeah.
Well, and I would like to say that Philip Johnston, who came in and did movement with us.
Incredible.
Also really helped enhance that feeling of the time period.
Yes.
How formal everything was, how symmetrical everything was. And we worked really hard on the presence, the posture, and those kind of things that helped us kind of stay in that world, and how people moved and bows and flourishes and
you know, this piece, because it is a period piece, we spent a lot of time doing research, you know, real research on this. We talked about everyone that you saw on stage except for the servants, those are real people.
Yeah.
So you can look them up. You can look them up in books and on Wikipedia and all those things. And so that was really fun, you know, discovering a little bit about each of the characters and who they were in real life.
I think that the king also, one thing I'm going to take away from this is that the king, I think, helped me become a better appreciator of opera, because when he said that he doesn't want to understand what Farinelli's saying, like, do you want to understand what the birds are saying? It was like, that's just brilliant, because I've always like sat here thinking it's Italian, it's German, whatever, I don't know what's going on, but I do think it is. Then I could just sit back and close my eyes and just take in James' magical voice, and it didn't matter. I mean, you probably think you were doing all sorts of, you were telling a story, but I was just riding the story. I was just feeling it.
Yeah, it's actually, I don't mind. I love seeing people close their eyes and kind of just take it in that way. I mean, I can't stare at everyone too much, but I definitely take it.
So I wasn't sleeping. If you did look up a stage left, I was taking it in.
You had a really good audience.
You did.
It's been wonderful, actually. Every show, they've been very responsive.
Lovely.
Well, this is going to be a massive test of my editing skills.
Okay.
To trim some out of here. But thank you so much.
Thanks
and I
so
just
much, Eric.
Really encourage my listening audience to come to Station Theater over the next 2 weekends to see the show. It's really beautiful, and it just, you know,
it's worth the time.
There's a line about the, yeah, it's not a bullfight.
it doesn't
get you to bed. It doesn't get you to bed at a decent time of night, but it is still worth seeing. And it's not, it's a casserole, not a, I don't know. I don't want to get all my notes out. All right. Well, thanks to the cast of Farinelli and the King at the Station. It's great talking to you and really wonderful seeing the show tonight.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
We appreciate it.
You were listening to WEFT. That was See You at the Show. Now, it is time for Surfabilly Freakout Radio.
You are listening to WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM. This has been the Weft Courier for Thursday. Join us for the Weft Courier every weekday for Democracy Now! At 4 p.m., followed by 2 additional programs of information and analysis. Up next, Surfabilly Freakout Radio.
The views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated,